welcome. Thank you so much for coming. It is such an honor to be here in front of you all speaking tonight and to be sharing the podium with this master teacher, Eugene Schwartz, whose books and articles and songs and plays and verses and materials I have used and have inspired me for at least a decade now. So it is such an honor to be standing here with Eugene. In fact, when I was first asked to do this, I immediately thought, why me? Could I possibly stand here next to this incredible teacher? And my dear friend Fiona said, okay, just speak about what you're passionate about. Share your passion of Waldorf education. And I thought, all right, I can do that. So thank you so much for having me. So as a class teacher, as we all know, the place to begin is with a picture. And so I bring you a picture of April of 1919. In Stuttgart, Germany. Europe was ravaged by World War I. And Rudolf Steiner, a spiritual philosopher, stood before a group of factory workers and brought to them a picture of social renewal. Well, after the lecture, the owner of the factory, which was a cigarette factory of all things, came up to Dr. Steiner and asked him, what can we do to ensure that this travesty never happened again? That this world war that has just ripped Europe apart, what can we do to ensure that human beings will not act this way ever again in the future? And Rudolf Steiner said, it has to happen with developing a new way of thinking. It has to come from education. It has to begin with the children. Because the old way of thinking that got us into the problem is not going to get us out of the problem. And we see that today in our culture with the terrible things that are happening in our economy, in our environment, in our political sphere, in our social sphere. And we know that the way of thinking that's gotten us into this mess is not going to get us out. We are not going to technologize our way out of global warming. But a new way of thinking has to come in. And so the owner of the cigarette factory said, yeah, let's do it. You can use my factory. We'll start a school for the children. We'll do it right here. This was in April. In May, the teachers were selected, and these weren't teachers. He selected those who had already had an understanding of his spiritual philosophy. And the teachers were selected in May. In August, they had a 2-week crash course. And remember, these weren't teachers. These were people that came from all walks of life. They had this 2-week crash course, and in September, in Stuttgart, Germany, the first Waldorf school opened its doors. There were 256 students in the school in September. 6 years later, there were 1,000 students in the school. And now we stand as one of the fastest growing educational movements in the world. Most of our schools are in Europe, but we have 170 schools currently in the United States. We have 30 schools here in Canada, and the movement is going strong. So what was this that Steiner gave in that crash course? And what was it that he gave to us to help us to start this new social renewal? Because we are here for nothing less than to change the world. It's a big task that we have standing before us. Well, Steiner gave us first this picture of the human being, which he had developed through his own insights into his own clairvoyance. He took the time to take what he could see. He could see the spirit that permeated everything. Every human being, every piece of matter, every plant, every tree. And he was able to take what he could perceive and write down his steps as he went through this spiritual initiation so that others could follow behind him. Well, through this, he developed a picture of the developing human being that he saw could be applied to education and that we could use it to help to develop this new way of thinking. And so the very first premise that we as teachers hold is that we see the children as spiritual beings. And that we, as they come to us, at the very beginning, we see that they come as these little tiny infants, this little tiny infant that we so joyfully have there in the back. But they're not complete. We can see when we look at them. They're not able to get up and walk around like Buddha, right? Walk across the earth and talk and... But there's pieces of them that still are not there. So Steiner was able to show us that the child very slowly incarnates, that the human being slowly comes into this physical being. And this slow incarnation that he talked about in 7-year cycles, between birth and the final drop of the ego into the organism at the age of 21 is what we call childhood. And he gave us this developmental path of education where we can not only help them to learn the skills they're going to need as they go out into the world, but we can make sure that through the curriculum, we can help them to become whole human beings. And as a whole human being, this new way of thinking is what Steiner called free thinking. And so we're working here in our Waldorf schools towards helping to develop whole, free thinking human beings. And so in the first 7 years, the child is developing its physical body. Now there are forces that we don't see that are working within the child. And the main force that's working in the first 7 years is a force that Steiner called the life force, or the etheric force. And the life force, you can have a clear picture of it, because if you can picture the body when it's alive, and then that same body after the soul has passed into death and the corpse, you can clearly see that there's something that's animating that body that we can't see. So that's what Steiner's talking about is the life force. It's what giving the body life. In the first 7 years, this life force is working very hard. The infant comes into the world given the what's inherited from the parents. So the physical matter of the infant is what the mother and the father have come together and given the child. But through the first 7 years, with the help of the etheric body, the child is going to transform that into its very own physical organism. Until by the time they reach 7, there's nothing left in the body that came from the parents. And every cell and every part of their being has been transformed. And so this is the work of the first 7 years. And the way that the child is learning about the world through this time is through taking the world and it's just streaming into them. And the main learning force here is the force of imitation. And so they are like one great big sense organ. And the sensations are just coming into them. And they're imitating everything they see in the world. And so one thing that Steiner talked to us about that was very important is that in order for them to be able to take what they're sensing from the outside world and take it into their etheric body and transform it into their own physical organism, is that they do this through play, through unorganized, unstructured, open play. And it's amazing, because now, on my way to the lecture here tonight, the scientific world is proving what Steiner talked to us about. Here in Scientific America, the serious need for play, how it improves your creativity, emotional health, removes stress. And this is an amazing article that you have to take time to see. This is free imaginative play is crucial for normal, social, emotional, and cognitive development. It makes us better adjusted, smarter, and less stressed. So finally, scientific world is catching up with us a little bit here. And so in these first years, this open play, allowing the children to experience the world and not to start to bring formal instruction. Because the shadow side of this work that the etheric is doing is that if we go in and begin to think that we have to instruct the children in everything that they do, if we decide that we want to mold them perhaps into a young violinist at the age of 3, or perhaps we want them to be a basketball star, we're going to start that training at the age of 4, we are actually compromising those etheric forces. We are actually compromising their ability to build their physical body. One example of this that I saw really clearly was when I was watching once a geography bee. And these were the best and brightest 5th graders in the United States. And they were all sitting behind little podiums like this, being asked questions that college professors probably couldn't answer off the tops of their heads. And I'm watching this, and the one thing that stood out to me the strongest was when I looked at them, they looked so unhealthy. There was the paleness to their skin. They were all very thin. There was only 3 out of the 12 that were behind the podiums that didn't have glasses. And these were 5th graders. And it was a real example to me of this over-intellectualization. These children's bodies had actually been compromised by too much information at too young an age, too much instruction. So as we come through these first 7 years, the kindergarten teacher has to be very aware of how they are being with the children, because the children are sensing everything they're doing. So if you ever watched your kindergarten teacher, son, I was one for a while and decided I was better suited to the grades, because they are amazing. Every gesture, every movement, how they set down their paper, how they walk across the room, how they pick up a pencil. Every single movement is conscious, and they are truly like priests and priestesses in their realm. And the children, through this, are having this opportunity to imitate this truly high, holy, moral human being. Well, as the children start to grow through these first 7 years, they come to a critical phase right around 6 years old. It can happen at about 5.5 to 7, but this change begins to happen where their physical body has really come to a place where it's strong, it's been built. You can start to see changes. They elongate in their limbs. You start to see a little bit of a neck coming in. And the biggest change that we begin to see is this change of teeth. And this is really the etheric force is from the inside pushing out. It is ready to come out. It has been inside working on the body, transforming this physical matter, taking what the child inherited and making it its own. And now it's ready to be free. And so this change of teeth begins to happen. Now, a lot of us might think, oh yeah, I lost my teeth. This wasn't so big a deal, right? We've all done it. But if you've ever actually seen what this looks like, there's this incredible picture. It's going to be hard to see, but I'll put it in the back. Those of you in the front might get a picture of what is actually happening in the heads of these small children. It is just outrageous. It's amazing that they can even sit in the classroom at all with us. And really, the six-year-old goes through a phase where we could call them like a bubbling pot. You know, they really can hardly sit still. You know, this little child who was just happy to sit and sew at 5 is suddenly at 6 climbing the walls. This is the very first beginnings of starting to see that there's a change happening. And suddenly, their play changes. No longer are they just able to take any object, and you know, this block becomes a hat, becomes a bird on their shoulder, it becomes an iron, it becomes, suddenly, it's a block. Now I have to think, what do I want to do with that block? And the six-year-old now comes to the kindergarten with ideas, okay? They come into the kindergarten and say to their teacher, I'm going to build a house today. And I'm going to need 3 friends, and I'm going to need this block and that table, and I'm going to need that over there. And they might spend the entire time in kindergarten talking about what they're going to do. They might not actually ever even get to doing it, right? But they come in with ideas. This is really the beginning of showing us that there's a change happening. Doesn't necessarily mean that we should sit them down and start to teach them their ABCs. But it means that they're showing us that they're heading towards that place, and that we should start to be aware. But actually, what they need is a little bit more time, right? They're coming to this place where the etheric is starting to be freed up. But if we give them time, especially these younger six-year-olds, these summer birthdays that some of you might be starting to look at already, they have a little bit more time. It's amazing what they do with their play. They build the tallest towers in the kindergarten. You might see every chair in the kindergarten now piled up and someone's sitting up at the top. Or the tables start to get dragged out. They want to play big and they want to play hard. And if they're given that opportunity, that by the time they do come to us in grade 1, they are really ready to learn. And I don't know a Waldorf teacher that I've ever met that hasn't said that those summer birthday children are the top of their class. And it's really because they really had that blessing of being able to have that one last year in kindergarten where they could take those ideas and actualize them. And they weren't just put behind a desk when they were a bubbling pot. Because if you can imagine trying to sit behind a desk when this is going on, it's not an easy task. So I have 2 daughters, both who were summer birthdays, and both who stayed that extra year in kindergarten, happy to ever talk to anyone who might be in the place of making that decision, because it was the best thing I've ever done for them. They are both so mature and centered and joyful in their learning, and I'm so happy that I came to that decision with both of them. So now they come to us in grade 1. And these etheric forces are free. Now, when they're in the kindergarten, they have a kind of memory, but it's a kind of memory we might call a habit memory. This is one of the reasons our kindergarten teachers really want to help create that habit memory. And they're probably telling you to make sure you have a regular bedtime, make sure they're having regular meal times, that your structure and your rhythm and your routine is so important. Well, these things come into the child now and become part of their organism, this habit memory. But a new kind of memory now is becoming freed as the child reaches their seventh year. And this is a picture memory. And Steiner gives us the tools of working with pictures to help them to come into this next phase of learning. And so a story curriculum was created so that from the age of 7 through 14, oral stories would be told that will meet the child at each stage of their development so that they can not only be nourished at a soul level, but that they also can develop these living picture memories. And these living picture memories then become the foundation that all of the academic learning comes from. Now in grade 2, they're building towers. Today, it was amazing because I'm preparing for this lecture, and there's my grade 2 students, and they're building things as tall as they possibly can. And one blessed young student, who shall remain nameless, comes to me and says, "Miss Nelson, I know the trick of building towers." I said, "Yeah, please tell me." He said, "You have to have a big bottom." I said, "No, tell me more." "Well, if you don't have a big bottom and it's too thin at the bottom, then all the stuff gets too heavy on the top and it falls over." I thought, thank you. Because it's exactly the premise of the early grades of Waldorf education, that the broader we can build this base, the taller the tower will come. So some of the things we do might seem like it's a bit slower than it is in the public schools. You know, our children are learning to read in kindergarten. Why aren't they learning to read here in Waldorf School in grade 1? And it's because here in Waldorf School, we're actually thinking about where they're going to go and who they're going to be in 10, 20, 30 years. And we want them to be the tallest tower that they can be. And if we know that what's happening to their physical body when they're very young children, I don't want to do anything that's going to compromise their physical health as adults. I want to make sure that they can be as whole and healthy as could possibly be. So they come to us in grade 1, and now this new forces of memory have begun to emerge, but it doesn't mean that now all of a sudden we start the academic learning, because they still are transitioning. They really are still coming to us with the powers of imitation very strongly. It's always a shock when teachers go from grade 8 down to grade 1, and you know, they do this, and all the children do this. And I was coming from grade 6, and I would stand up ready to conduct them in a song, forgetting, and every one of my grade 1s started to do this. But okay. So they're still very strong in that power of imitation. And so through imitation, still much of our learning is happening. But when they come to us, they're ready for the adult in front of them to be the author of what they're going to know. They are ready for an authority. They come to you each day and they sit there and they look at me with these big eager eyes. What are you going to teach me today? And they really, it's their birthright for us to instruct them at this age. They really deserve for us to come in each day prepared and ready to bring them something new. So in grade 1, we begin by bringing them a very important lesson. This is the only lesson that Steiner actually wrote down exactly what the teacher should say. And he said that you should walk up to the chalkboard and you should draw one very straight line. And then next to it, the curved line. And then begins a whole exploration of how everything in the world is made of the straight and the curved line. A profound concept. But when the children gobble up eagerly and they begin to look for it everywhere in the playground, "Look, Miss Nelson, a straight line. Oh, I see a curved one." Everywhere they go. And this begins the first block in form drawing that then leads in to when we begin to make their letters and their numbers. Now the letters began in human consciousness as originally pictures that were made small enough so that they could be quickly documented, and then eventually the pictures fell away and we're left with these very abstract symbols that don't connect to anything in the child's world of experience. And so we take the children back to that time, to the time of picture writing, and we bring them through story and through the artwork to be able to draw. Perhaps first it is, you might tell a fairy tale, of a mountain, and then the mountains are drawn, and then from the mountain, the letter M comes out. So the children begin to have a real living picture of this letter M. Now, I've noticed in my time of teaching that some children are absolutely picture thinkers. Without that picture in a public school, they would have been in a special education program, because they don't think, they don't absorb this abstract symbol. It makes absolutely no sense to them. But they see a mountain. They see fire. They see a fish. They see water. And they have now a picture, memory of what that symbol is and a sound that associates to it. And they're able to then move on then into the world of reading and writing. Now in Waldorf, we come first through the experience, through the will force that so strongly guides those first 7 years. And so we bring them not to reading at the beginning, but we start with writing. And so the children first learn to write their letters, and then the words come in, and then whole sentences come in. And then in grade one, they are writing not see Dick run or Jane has Spock or whatever that silly stuff is, but they're actually writing beautiful words in the great, glorious castle there lived an enchanted princess. Because we still want them to have this glory in the language, this beauty in the language, and to be able to really be focusing on making every letter beautiful and artistic. And then from that, we start to come into the parts. Now the kindergarten teacher started this work already, perhaps when the children were in preschool, 3 and 4 years old. The children were hearing these stories. They've been listening to the oral stories all the way along. So to them, this is sheer play. They absorb the story, and they're ready. And then from that, slowly we're able to come then into how these sounds come together to make these words. And from their own writing, the children begin to read. At the end of grade one, the children make their own reader. And in my grade one class, it's from a play that we do, and then they write the play, something they've already memorized, and they take it home through the summer, and they can be reading their work and moving on. Now arithmetic, Steiner told us, is a very different process. Arithmetic is something that's intuitive. Preschool children know if you've given somebody more and they've gotten less. They know if that cookie is bigger than the one that they got, right? So mathematics is really something intuitive. And usually the kindergarten teachers find the children start counting all on their own, just sheerly through imitating what's in the environment. And by the time they come to us in grade one, most of them can count to 100 without ever having had any instruction in it at all. They are ready. And so Steiner gave us this wonderful marriage of mathematics and rhythm. And so that when we work with mathematics in grade one, so much of what we do is through rhythm. And so we're counting, and we're clapping, and we're stomping, and we're bringing the world of number into their bodies. And now with my class in grade two, they've already memorized a good 3/4 of their multiplication tables simply through playing in circle time. And rhythm sticks and beanbags, and we do all manner of this rhythmic multiplication and rhythmic counting that comes in. Another premise that we work with in mathematics is that the child is truly living in the whole. A young child feels that everything is connected to them. They might come, I had a student the other day, bump into a table, and he pushed the table right over. And you might think that he thought the table was alive, but no, he felt that this table was connected, that somehow he was still connected to that table. Where did that table end and he begin? He wasn't sure, but it hurt. Ready to get rid of that table. Well, slowly, that begins to change, but for the young first and second grader, they're still very much in the whole. They're still very much connected to the world around them. So we begin always with the whole. So we'll begin, perhaps, with the number 10. How many ways can you make me 10, right? So I'm not saying, what's 5 plus 5? because then we're in the parts. Parts don't make as much sense to the child, starting with the whole. They live in the whole. So I'll say, how many ways can you make me 10? 8 plus 2, 5 plus 5, 7 plus 3, you know, 12 minus 2. And before you know it, they've found, you know, 100 ways to make the number 10. And so slowly from beginning with that whole in grade 1, again, working with it in grade 2, then we can start to come to the parts. Because in grade 3, a huge developmental shift happens. Now the child has been coming from this place of the whole, of being connected, of feeling a part of this beautiful world, and suddenly a new force comes to meet them. This new force is that of the astral body, and this is a whole other body different from the etheric. The etheric body, which really works with rhythm, the etheric body loves routine. The astral body likes polarity. The astral body likes ups and downs, highs and lows, black and white, and this is what's coming to meet the child in grade 3 at the 9-year change. Well, through this, the child then begins to feel, I'm alone in the world. I'm not connected to this table anymore. I'm suddenly not connected to mom and dad. And you know what? Mom and dad and the teacher might not actually know everything. They don't know what's going on inside of me. Suddenly they realize, wait, nobody knows what I'm thinking. There's a whole world inside of me that nobody's aware of. And for many children, this can be quite a crisis. This is a time when they start to questions, big things. Why am I here? What happens to me after I die? Does everything die? Big questions. And Steiner likened this to a fall from paradise, that they've been in this paradise world of early childhood, and at grade 3, suddenly that paradise falls away. And so he gives us the stories of the Old Testament, the stories of Adam and Eve being cast out of paradise, and what did they need to survive as human beings on the earth? They needed to know how to be human beings, how to build shelter, how to grow food, how to cook food, how to make clothes, how to measure things, how to observe the world around them. So grade 3 is filled with the practical arts, to really as a balm to this time of crisis. I'm going to move quickly now because I'm running out of time. In grade 4, the children come to, they're still a bit in this 9-year change. For many of them, it doesn't completely come through until they're reaching more 10, some of them 11. And in grade 4, there can be a whole tumultuous world of happening. Many personalities are happening within them. And we meet this by bringing to them the Norse myths. Now, the gods of the Norse myths are outrageous characters. And they have all of the qualities of what the children are feeling going on inside of them. There's, you know, there's the devilish god. There's the very big, strong god. There's the sad little princess. There's all this whole myriad of characters that come through the Norse myths. Well, also, they've come through this 9-year change, and the children are able now to be able to see things more objectively. So they're able to look at the world of plants, at the world of animals, at the world around them in geography. Now they're suddenly awake to that they live in a place. And this school has a neighborhood, and this neighborhood's in a town, and this town is in a city, the city's in a country. And so we bring them local geography in grade 4. And coming to grade 5 is another lovely shift, and I'd love to leave that to our dear Mr. Schwartz.
Well, Sarah gave me such a build-up before, but I really want to say, hearing her speak, the honor is all mine, being up here with her. You have a real gem in this school, among many gems. Now, as a woman, she's able to intuit everything she has to say. As a male, I need to have an electronic device near me. I won't use it, but it just makes me feel more secure to have it close by. So let me just put this in. And we're hoping that the content of this dual lecture is going to be available to you as an audio file on your computer or a CD. So talk to Mary in a week or so. We'll see. And I certainly hope Sarah's voice was caught. So Sarah was giving us this wonderful picture of the way in which a Waldorf school is not only teaching the child something, you know, I have something to fill you up with, some information that the province says you've got to know in grade 2, 3, or 4, but is accompanying the child, that this is an accompaniment. Some wonderful inner and outer things are going on in the child's nature, physiologically, psychologically, we could say even spiritually. And this is a curriculum that moves along with the child, that is sensitive to every nuance of growth and change. We are not a linear system. We don't feel that children just sort of move, you know, one tile at a time forward, but rather that a child's progress is organic, it's natural. A plant now and then seems to stop its growth completely. That might be the bud. So the child may be moving forward and suddenly hesitate on the brink of a threshold of a new stage. Sarah spoke so beautifully of the 9-year change, a time when the child almost wonders, do I want to go forward or do I want to go back into early childhood? So there'll be times when the child moves forward, steps back. There'll be times when the stepping back seems to be almost a complete reversal of everything we've done with them, only then we watch them step back so that they can leap forward. It's wonderful to see this beautiful and often rather enigmatic growth pattern in the child, but the curriculum tries again and again to meet it. So Sarah left us on the brink of the end of childhood. The child is now moving out, as she said so well, like this is the house that Jack built, you know, one step after another, finally taking in the whole province of British Columbia. But there's more to the world than that. And in fifth grade, they're going to learn about the geography of all of Canada, of all of North America. I learned from Marianne, her children even learned all 50 states, which I said is a lot more than most American children could do. So they expand out in space, but there's another expansion as well in fifth grade, which is our way of acknowledging the profound change that the child is going through between fourth and sixth grade. And fifth grade is the fulcrum here. They expand in time as well, because in fifth grade, we begin to teach ancient history, ancient cultures. And in a very, very rapid progression, the children learn about ancient India. They go back to cultures which at least go back to 8, possibly even 10,000 before the Common Era. So 12,000 years back in history they go. Ancient India, they learn about Hinduism. They learn about these remarkable, many-headed, many-limbed gods. They learn the great epics of India, the Mahabharata, the Ramayana, and the wonderful figures like Hanuman, who arise and to this day are so powerful in Indian culture. And then they go on to Persia, a very different land, one where human beings have to work much harder to make the recalcitrant cold mountains yield something, to make the drier ground that's north of the Fertile Crescent be arable for farming. So this is a more austere existence. They learn about how civilization then begins to arise so wonderfully at the confluence of the Tigris and Euphrates rivers. They learn then about the beginnings of Persian culture and how this moves on to Babylonia, Mesopotamia, ancient Egypt, a history study that fifth graders never want to leave because of its myriad details and its wonderful myths. And finally, buildings that we can still look at. Buildings that are so ancient
that the pyramids and the Sphinx have disappeared time and again in the course of history under the desert sands. In fact, most recently, it was Napoleon who actually had them dug down to the full extent of their grandeur today. That recently were they partly subsumed in the desert. And then finally, they go on as the fifth graders in the Vancouver Waldorf School are right now learning about ancient Greece as well. So they go from about 10,000 BCE to the Golden Age of Athens. Some teachers might even go as far as Alexander the Great, all the way up to about 400 BCE. Quite a progress for the children. But even as they are bidding farewell to their own childhood, in a way they are examining the foundations, the roots of human existence. They are becoming now human, not only in terms of feeling that they're part of this great space of the whole earth, but that they are part of this great time continuum. They have a legacy there. And when Rudolf Steiner proposed this as the curriculum, he was asked, well, you know, why is it so important for European children, for this was Germany circa 1920, why should European children be going so deeply into ancient history? Isn't that the stuff of universities? And why should they be spending so much time studying Asia? And he said, in time, you will understand why we're doing this. And this is why Waldorf schools, for years and years, were the only schools in Europe, and when they moved to the United States in the late 1920s, the only school in the United States as well, in which young children were learning about Asian culture. We're learning to appreciate the multicultural vastness of what Asia, what the Orient, what ancient cultures have to bring. I should mention in sixth grade, when the children study the early and later Middle Ages and also ancient Rome, they also learn about Muhammad, his life, and the rise of Islam. And for, as far as I know, 50 years or more, Waldorf schools were the only schools in the Western world in which school children learned about Islam. How differently things might be today if more children had at least that much in their education. Now, of course, schools all over are scrambling to do it, but the way the Waldorf child learns it, it's a sense of this being part of the grand tapestry of time in which they too are wonderful co-participants. So here again, Steiner gave something which was striking and a little bit incomprehensible to his contemporaries, but he said that by the end of the 20th century, the need for this kind of study would prove itself. And not insignificantly, when the children first hear about ancient India, it's the first time that they also hear, historically, not in any sense to convert them to one way of thinking or another, they learn about reincarnation and they hear the word karma. And they learn about the caste system, a system based on an understanding of the sort of meritocratic way in which karma would work. And that's left there. But as with so much else in Waldorf education, there are always several things going on at once. There's what the child is learning at this moment, what they're getting excited about, what they're writing about, what they're drawing, and so on. But we know that accompanying it is what they learned the year before, what they learned 2 or 3 years before. Experiences they had in kindergarten are to some extent bubbling up now and then and meeting what they're learning. So they hear a little bit about the wheel of karma, the wheel of destiny, as it were, in fifth grade. And this gets them ready because in sixth grade, as we heard, third grade represents a time of a very great, profound change in human life. The same is true of sixth grade, the 12 and a half year change. This is when a child takes on his or her own destiny. Up until now, even if they've sort of rebelled against their parents here or there or wanted to separate. But basically, they've been carried, if not in the parents' womb anymore or in the parents' arm anymore, at least in the back seat of the van, they've been carried to school every day. This idea that they're going to this or that school, that they have this or that teacher, that's their parents' idea. And now in sixth grade, they really have to make it their own. Now, in a way, they stand with a far greater degree of independence and certainty and strength, and yet, of course, behind it, tremendous sensitivity, vulnerability, a sense, again, of being poised on a very profound threshold. So this is where puberty and the beginnings of adolescence meet. And how do we meet this? Once again, Sarah and I can only give you little snapshots, the tip of the iceberg, really, in terms of what the children learn in any given year. And I hope that you'll avail yourself of the incredible work that is on display in back, of work done by children through the grades in the Vancouver Waldorf School. In sixth grade, for the first time, we teach them laboratory science. Now, who would think that laboratory science would have anything to do with human destiny, with the child's psychological needs at that age? This is where Waldorf is really unique, that every subject that's taught is not only there so that they'll get good FSA scores, but it's also there so that they will, in a way, have what T.S. Eliot would have called the objective correlative, something out there meeting something within. So what's happening at 12, 12 and a half? There's a sense of an inner darkness, something that the parents, in a way, were always filling. This is what we do in our home. Say please and thank you. Sit up straight at the table. No, you can't wear that today. All of these things, in a way, that have been filling them, they're pushing away, but they haven't yet anything to fill it up with themselves. So there's a sense that there's a kind of darkness and a kind of silence there. And then one day the teacher says to them, for today's block, we're not going to use the classroom. We're going to go into such a room. Why? Why are we going in there? You'll see when we get in there. They go in, they sit down, the lights are turned off, and they realize the teacher has blackened all of the windows with black paper or something like that. When the lights are off, the room is completely dark. And now the teacher, depending on how he or she works with this, can introduce one aspect of physics to them, or even two. Out of the silence, acoustics, the science of sound, is born in their souls. And out of the darkness, optics, color, the science of light, will be presented to them. So they go into a space of darkness, and within that, the teacher then may start to shine a light from a slide projector through an aquarium of clear water, and perhaps then adds colors to it, and the children watch as these merge and mix. Where the teacher may just say, everybody be absolutely quiet. You can't use your eyes right now. Use your ears. What do you hear in here? Nothing. Be quiet. Listen. Listen. And it may be for the first time ever the children are really, really listening. As a teacher of many years, I can tell you, getting children to listen even for a minute is a great achievement for a teacher. They're really listening, or as that light shines, they are really seeing for the first time. And we are honoring them. We are celebrating that now, in a way, your sense organs are portals for you and you alone. Now this is your life. This is really the way you are going to perceive the world. Now, what is this about? A dark room, a light shining, or quiet silence? Isn't this a kind of modern, scientifically oriented rite of passage? Often we're asked in Waldorf schools, you know, you're so good at all of this, why don't you have a rite of passage for the kids? Because we're not going to have our child confirmed, or, you know, we've decided not to send him to Hebrew school for bar mitzvah lessons. You do it. You do it. And actually, the teachers do it all the time. It's thoroughly there in the 6th, 7th, and 8th grade curricula. This rite of passage, which comes especially through the sciences. Because in natural science, the children are now going to start to learn about human physiology, the secret of their own body. Human anatomy, the secret of their own skeleton. Like Hamlet, they're going to confront that skull. Alas, poor Yorick, I knew him well. In a way, they're going to be looking at the depth of their own being. So here it is. It's science. It's objective. It's cut and dry. It's very modern. We can do all of that stuff. We live in the 21st century. But the way in which it's done, and most importantly, the time in which it's done, as King Lear tells us, the ripeness is all. We wait for that right moment. And optics and acoustics, or simple machines, or hydraulics, or pneumatics, which would have been fine in fourth grade, even third grade. Some schools will do that sort of thing. It says in the syllabus, we have to get through these sciences. It would be there. They could learn it. They could do all right on a test. But it will not touch them inwardly. It will not meet them and match what's going on within. And that is our benchmark. That's our test. And it's really a test for the teacher above all. When do I teach this block? Do I start the year with physics? Do I have an older class who are really chomping at the bit, who want to go into that dark room first thing? Or do I wait till the middle of the year? Or do I have a young class? I'm going to wait till the very end. And that's going to be the crescendo of the year. It's wonderful. Every teacher's, you know, given the basic colors, is given the palette, but how do you blend those colors? When do you use red? When do you use green? That's what the Waldorf teacher is asked to do. And they can only do that out of a knowledge and an understanding of their own children. So this is the way in which the Waldorf school strives to meet the adolescent. And there's something else, of course, that's very important. And everybody sort of knows this about a Waldorf school. But until you've really worked, as I have, a lot in the public school world, you don't appreciate what it means. I taught for years in Waldorf schools and never realized this is what we were creating. For 3 years, I was a fellow at a very prestigious foundation in the United States called the Carnegie Foundation for the Advancement of Teaching. And I worked there exclusively with public school teachers, all of whom had to go through a battery of exams and tests to qualify for this fellowship. So it was quite an honor to be with these master teachers. What did they talk about every day that we got together for our various convocations and seminars? How to create a safe classroom. Now, they didn't only mean a classroom that was free of violence. Of course, we all want that, and we would imagine that's very unusual in a Waldorf setting at all. But they meant safety on a number of levels. And I realized, my gosh, this is what we're all about. The safety for a child to ask a question about math and not be laughed down, not be sort of intimidated by the teacher. I already talked about that. Feel free to ask whatever you want. Go ahead. I already talked about that one. You know, that they're safe to be able to ask the same question again and again. That they're safe to be able to share things out of themselves and not feel that people are going to laugh at them or poke fun or ostracize them in one way or another. These are very simple matters. You know, and of course we have today in most Waldorf schools what you have, the social inclusion, a whole element of the school that's there to guarantee and assure and keep developing that degree of safety, that children really feel They can say what they have to say. They can really be who they are. And this is the most difficult task for a teacher. Not only to teach the children everything that's on the curriculum, but to give it to them in such a way that their particular individual needs are met. And this is another great difference going from the nursery kindergarten years through the primary school years into the upper grades, that in the early years, we want most to create a group. It's just what Sarah was bringing so beautifully, that statement her student had made. Have that big foundation, you know, feel that you're really part of the group. So what are we always asking the children to do? You probably have done this at parent evenings. How do you start? Stand up and form a circle where you're holding hands to your right and left, where you're feeling, you know, even if it's a girl's hand or a boy's hand. The girls always roll their eyes. The boys always wipe their hands. It's, you know, amazing. That you hold the hands of your classmates because you are all one. And in a way, the children are like the planets moving around the sun. And the kindergarten teacher, the class teacher in those early grades is the sun in a way. And the children move around, you know, really orbiting. That teacher, as you know, they come home. And as Sarah said, you know, if the teacher did this while telling a story, the child retells the story and remembers they have to do this or whatever. But then, starting in sixth grade subtly, coming more and more to the fore in seventh and eighth grade, and finally, basically, as the high school modus operandi from day one, that is turned inside out. And suddenly, every student becomes the center of the universe, and the teachers, in a way, are moving around. He needs more grammar. I think he's doing well in music. Let's bring more woodworking. I can bring that together with grammar. That will help. So the teachers now individualize and individuate the curriculum so that the same subjects are taught to everyone else. They're doing the same main lesson book content and so on, but it's given to each one according to his or her needs. You know, from each according to his abilities, to each according to his needs. Who was it who said that? Does anybody remember? Karl Marx. Yes, the Waldorf philosophy. So that is really what goes on in the high school. It's a complete reversal. It's very, very different. And that's why you don't have a class teacher in the high school. That's why you have sponsors or advisors, usually a man and a woman, to give that sort of polarity picture that's there. And it really now becomes the individuation of the curriculum, that every young man and woman is really going to receive it and give it back in a very unique way. It's a little bit like the example that one might give, you know, the difference between a little child and a teenager. The little child looks up at his parents and says, look at them. They feed me. They shelter me. They anticipate all of my needs. They must be gods. And the teenager looks at the parents and says, look at them. They feed me. They shelter me. They anticipate my needs. I must be a god. And this sort of reversal is exactly what the high school is there for in a certain way. Not to build up their egotism, but rather to really help them find their way and find their course into those years. So some people ask me about the title of tonight's lecture. Why do you say from a part to the whole? Waldorf is from the whole to the parts. Aha, yes, that's true. But I have found in school after school that I visit that the incredible perfection of the kindergarten, and there's no part of a Waldorf school that is more penetrated, that is more wonderful and beautiful, and that is more the wonder of the school and the admiration of all the teachers than the kindergarten. One can almost feel, how could you ever go beyond this? You know, you would just want the grade school to have that kindergarten teacher moving up. We have millet on Monday and bread baking on Tuesday and so on. There's really a longing in all parents for that. And we just want to show that every part of Waldorf has a kind of inherent perfection. But it's not that we want to get stuck in that perfection and say, as Faust said, you know, let this moment linger forever. But rather to recognize, just because it has served the child so well, it has given them what they need, that part of human growth is always saying no to that. And let's move on to the next. It's going to be shaky, it's going to be difficult, it's going to be strange. And parents often experience the first grade as being, whoa, it's so different from the kindergarten. Is this the way it's supposed to be? The ninth grade, wow, you know, Mr. Smith never said that to the children. Mr. Smith never asked that, as though the high school should just be a continuation of the lower school. By no means. Waldorf is very bold about the leaps the children take. We really want to accompany them in these great jumps in life, these great thresholds. The writer Grace Paley once wrote a beautiful book of short stories called Enormous Changes at the Very Last Minute. And anybody who's lived from the year 2001, or at least September of 2001, until this day, has seen how the 21st century is making the 20th century look like a preschool, in a way. The changes that are occurring, the, you know, institutions like banks that have lasted for 200, 300 years smoothly without a wrinkle through ups and downs of the economy are disappearing overnight. What we want children to learn today is not so much information, which is very much connected, a lot of it, to older parameters and older paradigms. We want them to be poised. We want them to be ready. We want them, as Sarah would say again, to have that strong foundation which only a Waldorf nursery kindergarten can give children. We want them to have that sense of confidence that this world is theirs and they belong in it, that the primary grades give. We want them to have that sense of the continuity of human life. As I told the parents in my class, when the first war in Iraq began, I said, right now, the children, your child in fifth grade, knows more about Iraq from the history that she has learned than most of the generals leading the troops there. It's pretty amazing what Waldorf children know about the world, what's happened before. And as we know, those who have not learned the mistakes of the past are destined to repeat them. So this is something Waldorf children have, a sense of the expanse of the world, a comfort in it, a sense of the continuity of time, and a feeling, I am part of this. I really can draw the legacy of the past along with me, but not to live in it or long for it, but rather to help push me and impel me to meet the future. So this is what we hope to bring. So it's sort of from each part of the Waldorf method, the Waldorf school, the children get a greater and greater sense of the whole of which they are a part. Now, I'd like to ask if Sarah would come back up and maybe we could field some questions for a few minutes. That be all right with you? Okay, thank you. And I'm going to sit down.
No.
So please, anyone. Well, that almost is a lecture in itself. Let me just repeat the question. I have in the past, whenever I come here, people quote lectures I've given in the past. Did I really say that? But I will accept that I did say that. I've said in the past that we can think of the kindergarten as being a kind of theocracy, where the rule or the leadership of priests and priestesses. It's a time in history. Every culture has gone through a theocratic period. And then that's usually been followed by a monarchy. And we could say that the class teachers and the specialty teachers working with them are like kings and queens and the aristocracy. And the children look up to them, not in the way you look up to a priest, where you have a very different set of ideals about that individual and feel that he or she, through their gesture alone, whether it's genuflecting or kneeling or the way they lift a wine or bread or some other special item or hold the Torah before the congregation, their gestures alone in the priest are enough to really elevate people. The king has to do more than gesture. The king or queen has to speak, and they make proclamations, and they, in a way, really bring their people into the world to give them power and security and strength. And in the high school, to go a bit further, there I've spoken of that world as being more like the democratic stage of history, which is very new, very young, very untested, and the high school teachers really try to assert the individuality of the student and give them a degree of freedom to find their own way, to figure out for themselves things, not to have it all spelled out by the teacher. And woe unto anyone who tries to skip one of these stages of history. And I think this is one of the problems in Iraq, that one had a very strongly theocratic culture. You can't just show up and say, "Hi, we're the United States of America and we're bringing democracy. Come on, everyone." There's got to be a kind of monarchic quality there in between, and that, alas, is a dictatorship very often. So you can't just jump from theocracy to democracy. It always fails. And that's what's important about the grade school. The children need to feel there's a monarchy, that their parents are like kings and queens in their lives, as are their teachers. And parents sometimes want to bring the democracy too soon to their children. And you'll end up with a little Iraq at home. Okay, is that helpful? Good.
Well, I like the analogy of the priestess in the kindergarten, the artist in the middle grades, and the scientist in the high school. So I really see that there's, as Eugene said so nicely, that you have the colors and the palette and the curriculum, and you can paint the picture in accordance to the children that sit in front of you is really, you know, a wonderful thing, where the kindergarten teacher is really having, we're really seeing these children in this stage of development where they're all going through their different phases, but the kindergarten teacher holds is fast, and she or he is holding this really holy, moral human being that stands before them. Also, the grade school teacher, we are moving and changing with our class. That is really a radical difference. I'm holding those grade one children and I'm seeing them in high school and beyond. I'm not seeing them as these fixed seven-year-olds that sit before me. I know where I'm going, I know where they've come from, and I'm dropping seeds all along the way. So it's a very, very different gesture that you have with the children.
Yes.
Grade three, and I know that in grade three and all the grades they're taught specific things based on where they're at in this, these seven-year cycles.
Yes.
And in grade three, I know they studied the Old Testament starting way back, even farther back in history, the beginning of first man and first woman, the creation of the earth and the planet.
Mm-hmm.
On with the story of Moses, they go out into the desert, and that's very much a part of the 9-year change.
Yes.
So I was just wondering, when you talked about that, you really mentioned the culture, and I think about creating civilizations that are so complex. Is there a part of the complexity of culture in the beginning of early culture and a growing civilization in the age and development of the great five child?
Well, the difference, I'd say, in what the, certainly the children learn fairy tales in first grade, which probably in the end are the very oldest stories, even though we get them through the Brothers Grimm, but all cultures share these stories for many, you know, thousands, tens of thousands of years. Second grade, they're brought more into the Middle Ages for a while with stories of saints or other good people, fables which date from 400, 500 BCE, Aesop and others. And then, as you said, the stories of the Hebrew Bible in third grade. But none of that is taught as history. That's all taught as experience. And even the Norse myths, they're really taught as though those gods are still really present. And the children relate to them in a very direct, very immediate way. It's only in fifth grade where the child now is, in a way, the attention is directed, there's something over there. It's no longer in our time. It was there. With each succeeding civilization that the fifth graders study, we are more and more able to present figures whose lives were documented, like Socrates and Sophocles and Plato and Aristotle and Alexander. So now there's a much more objective feeling. Now the children know they're studying history. It's no longer just the experience of myth or scripture or story that is happening in a way right now for them.
So when you say that those earlier years, the relation is more of a personal feeling, that sense is something that's also happening in me as that child, but in the older grades,
that's a very good point. It's a little bit more external, though certainly the story of a Heracles or the story of a Rama inspire the children. You know, the heroic sense is really awakened by these stories. But they know now, you know, this is how people saw the world those thousands of years ago. Look at the way the Egyptians drew everybody. They're all flat and they're always from the side. Why did they do that? And then they'll experience it as they draw it themselves. So it becomes more and more a kind of distancing from what's being learned and more of a sense of, okay, how do I relate to this? There's more freedom now for every child to find his or her own way. One child never wants to leave Egypt. Another has been waiting to study the Greek myths all of his life. You know, now this individuation begins here and there among fifth graders.
And there's this wonderful moment where they start to realize another flood, you know, or, oh my gosh, this again, yeah. You know, in this culture that was across the world from this one. And they start to really see that there's these connections that they're part of.
Yes.
As a parent of the school, I've been impressed for the extra protection that my children have received. I feel that childhood has been golden, and in many ways from the policies of what the children wear, advertising and media as well, I've been, I can't even put into words how grateful I've been to have the wisdom of the school that protects the children. And I wanted if you just have a few words on
there's another lecture.
Wait a moment. I have a recorded statement about that on my iPhone. Why don't you speak
you want me
to
me
that
field
one.
To
sure.
To the media?
Yeah.
Well, there's so much to say about the media, but I think what has always stood out to me the most is that as we're telling these stories and we're creating this curriculum, we're really, our hope is that the stories are going into the child to help them to really become this whole human being that I talked about, to help them on this soul development. Now, if I'm spinning this beautiful tale of Saint Jerome and the lion, and the child goes home and spends 3 hours playing video games and another hour of television before they go to bed, what I've done is completely ineffectual. So no matter how many watercolored hoops I jump through during the day at school, and no matter how many beautiful pictures I draw and stories I spin and meditations I do, the media counteracts it in the strongest possible way. So the best thing I can tell you is that you are absolutely wasting your time and your money if you're going to adhere to what the rest of the world is shoving into our poor young people. And it is the absolute hardest thing as a parent I have ever done, is keeping the media at bay from my children. And it is the thing that I'm the most proud of in who they are today. So it's something I could stand on a soapbox for an hour about. But I really beg and plead that these policies and these statements that we say are really there because we truly care about the future of humanity. I see video games as the destruction of young men. It's so sad in what's happening to young men, especially in our culture. And it's training them. I told my grade sixes once, when we were in a moment of having a conversation, that those games, you know, were designed to train you to be soldiers and go to war. And they said, no. I said, yes. Inside a tank is the exact screen and game that you're playing at home. Do you know those poor young men might not even know they're really killing people out there in Iraq? And this kind of conversation I would never have with young children, but it was around the snack table, and it's so, so profound, the damage that it's doing to our children. So, I don't know if that's a few words. I can say a lot more.
Yeah. Thank you.
Mm-hmm. Have you noticed that perhaps there's a trend for Waldorf methodology of teaching to be starting to become incorporated into the more mainstream schools? You showed them the magazine article, and it's like almost like an acceptance of the methods taught here, and that they're gradually becoming more accepted by the mainstream schooling. Have you noticed there's a trend that started happening?
Well, that's my hope. Yeah, I mean, that's really our dream, is that we won't just have a collection of Waldorf schools, but that we will have an educational movement that spreads worldwide, and that it is in the public schools. I think that in some areas that's happening.
In the United States.
And I think in other areas we're getting further away from it. So it's, you know, with this high stakes testing and this No Child Left Behind. But sometimes crisis creates change. And I think the educational movement, especially in the United States, which is what I know more clearly than in Canada, is in crisis. And they've pushed it so far into a corner that there's nothing but light now that can shine. So
yeah. Mm-hmm. Waldorf education is in the 30 or so years that I've, you know, sort of traveled around much more now than I used to. When I sit next to people on planes, when I, am staying at a hotel and just talk to somebody at the brunch table or whatever, more and more people have heard of Waldorf education than was ever the case. And there are now about 35 public Waldorf schools called charter schools in the United States, some of which are, especially in California, are succeeding in many respects to the degree that it's caught the attention of the State Department of Education, because especially of the success with English learning children, because Waldorf teaches things from so many different perspectives. So it is definitely something that's growing. A curriculum takes about 500 years to really show its full effect. The three R's that we have really goes back all the way to Charlemagne in the 9th century, the 10th century, and his idea that there should be universal literacy. That was when that began, and it got another boost at the time of the Renaissance, circa 1500. So what we're doing now is the artifact of something that was a really good idea and really right 500 years ago. And I think Waldorf is going to have that same sort of global effect. You're right now at the ground floor of something that's less than a century old. And in this 21st century, it's going to grow exponentially, privately and publicly.
And we're hoping that the broader the base of the movement, the taller our tower, right? So we don't need to fast track it.
Yeah.
So if you stay with that question, do you see in public schools and other schools that don't hear about Waldorf, do you find in general, is there anything Waldorfian that is in the mainstream education by some other way? Is there any like good that somehow gets in there that's related?
I visit a few public schools every year. That's a really good question. It's not as though Steiner was the only person with good ideas about education in the 20th century. He was sort of the most awake about what the needs were. And of course, others are going to awaken to these sooner or later as well. And I'd say one of the big steps public schools are taking is looping, allowing teachers to stay with a class, a grade school class, for 2 or 3 or sometimes 4 years. And always the teachers say, let me go on. Please, don't just call it an experiment. Let's keep going with this. Teachers like it. School districts can't always handle the logistics. So that's something that's very important. And I'd say secondly, though it goes up and down and up and down, but there is always nowadays some large group or other of teachers who are calling for the arts to be more present in education. There's a foundation called Edutopia, E-D-U-T-O-P-I-A, founded by the film director George Lucas of Star Wars fame. I think this is kind of his way of trying to be redeemed. And it's a foundation that advocates especially project-based education, of which Waldorf certainly represents that in many ways, and arts-enhanced education. They have a website which is filled with videos showing how public school districts, they're completely an advocacy group for public schools. They're not interested in private education. But they show the way in which the arts are used and enhance children's educational life. And some of the things they're doing are not terribly different from what we, of course, do just in the course of any day. So it's definitely coming, but the forces of opposition, you know, trying to make education more and more of a factory experience and make education more and more class-based, this is the great enemy of education in our time, that only the well-to-do should have well-educated children and everybody else is at the, you know, bargain basement of the test scores and is going to have inadequate education and become the working class. And that's something I think Waldorf began with factory children, and it's meant to be something that raises up all children in the world, not just those who can afford it. Maybe one last question, and then Sarah and I will stay and, you know, talk to people individually, too. Okay. Yes?
Yeah, I'm just curious. I don't know much about the methodology, except that you guys have said thank you. Very nice so far. Language poses a really important aspect, in, I guess, in our lives. But what's the methodology in the Waldorf system that sort of enhances the language ability of the individual?
Oh, foreign languages.
You mean foreign languages?
Yes.
Okay. Want to speak about that?
Shall I speak to that? Well, one of the indications that Steiner gave us was that children should have 2 foreign languages as they go through the curriculum. And this is not necessarily that they come out fluent in 2 foreign languages, but as the mainstream knows, and as many people know, there's this window of language acquisition when the children are young. And it comes from this time of imitation, yes, when they're still in this first 7 years, when they learn language by simply imitating what's around them. And this is really, and as everything in the first 7 years goes to building this physical body, the foreign languages as well. Actually, when they're learning the foreign languages in the early grades, this is coming into them through imitation. So in our school, many of our students have two languages in the early grades, and they are, and so as they're learning these languages, it actually goes and changes the physical body. And some of this happens through simply the changes in the larynx, so that they're able to imitate the dialect and the accent of the foreign language. And then later, it's keeping certain forces really awake and alive in the child, so as they move through the grades, that language continues all the way through high school, the foreign languages. And so in Hawaii, we had Spanish and Japanese, two very different languages, and the children had them consecutively through the day. And as little ones, they were able to impeccably imitate and repeat just what their teachers had said, and, you know, perfect little accents. And it's all done in the young grades through story and song, and it's not until about grade four, after this 9-year change, they've had a shift of consciousness where it starts to become more grammatical and, you know, and that different way of learning the language. We have French and German in the younger grades. Yeah. That answer?
Yes.
Yes.
Thank you very, very much. Thank you all. Thank you. Thank you for coming.
Thank you.
You're very welcome. A star is born.
She was so
amazing.
Oh my gosh.
It was a good combo. I knew it would be.
Oh, was this your idea?
We both came, kind of was a light bulb that came
oh,
right between us.
Oh, gosh, she's fantastic.
Well,
oh, she's so.
Teach her too. Well. Yeah, what a great combination.
It's very nice. Oh, I was very, very happy to do that.
Yeah, nice teach for you.
Yeah,
too.
Sure.
Oh,
like where the reception line.
Yeah.
Good night.
Yeah,
you're welcome. Thank you for coming. Thank you for coming. Thank you. Have a look at the children's work if you have a moment in back. You're very welcome.
Yeah, two twice in 1 week. It's pretty good.
Yeah, you're getting better.
Yeah. Thank you.
This is my husband, Doug.
Hi, nice to meet you. Hello. Thank you for coming.
Glad we could come to rain.
Thank you. Good night.
Thank you.
You're welcome. Good night.